And welcome to another episode of The Leaders Playlist. My name is Renee Craven, and today Anita Burke and I are discussing the book The Six Enablers of Business Agility by Karim Harbutt. We hope you enjoy. Hi Anita, how are you?
Hi Renee, great, thanks.
Today we are talking about the book The Six Enablers of Business Agility by Karim Harbutt. How to Thrive in an Uncertain World.
This was a good one.
It was a good one. Another short one again. I like how we choose a little more short books. We don't do that on purpose, but this one is 250-ish pages, give or take. We read this one a little while ago, and I think at the time that we read it, it resonated so strongly with us because of what we were doing at the time. Refreshing my brain yesterday, it was still, oh, yes, that's gold. Oh, yes. Yes. It was so, I love the way he writes. It's a really easy way to relate to what's going on. It's very personable the way he writes this book.
Yeah, very easy reading.
Yeah. And the way it's structured as well, you can kind of tell that he has put some thought into, or he's read a lot of books and he knows what he likes and how people can process and practice and reflect and things like that. So he's got pretty short chapters. He has reflection sections scattered throughout the chapters. He summarizes the chapter at the end of every chapter, and then he's got further reading and resources in there as well, which I really liked too.
Yeah, I love that too.
Grow our book list.
I thought the structure of the book as a whole was great. And particularly like you in preparation yesterday going back through the book, could just look at those little summaries at the end that are just nice short little dot-pointed summaries at every chapter, which just made it really easy to reinvigorate your memory and give you some prompts about what that was all about.
It was,
super, super handy. The other thing I like about the way he's written this book is the amount of examples and the type of examples that he uses. So lots that we were familiar with, but lots of stories that we hadn't heard before as well. And even with the stories and examples he used that we'd kind of heard of before, he often had a different perspective or new details that we hadn't heard before. So they weren't boring and repetitive and didn't sort of feel like you knew all these stories, here we go again. This is the same ones that always get used. But it was just a slightly different way he would explain them or use them or different perspective. It was well done.
We did talk when we were reading this book, we did talk about the timing of this book being published in 2021. There was no reference that we can remember of There's no reference of COVID in this book, and it could have been used as an example of a one of these uncertain times and how organizations responded from a business agility perspective. But he didn't. So we're assuming that he wrote this book before COVID happened, and then all of the other stuff that goes on to get it published happened while COVID was happening. So maybe there's a part two in it for him. Maybe he can do a special appendix or refreshed version of with some new stories of how organizations responded to COVID and what that said about their business agility.
And in saying that, though, I don't think that much, if anything, would change about the enablers themselves or how he talks about using those enablers. It still felt very relevant, even knowing that major thing in history happened since then.
He frames up the book with you know, reasons why he wrote it, and also he has a couple of graphs in there which I found fascinating. And I did go to an online meetup that where he was presenting at, and he showed these charts in that meetup as well. But he's illustrating why or what kind of pace of change that is happening in the world today, and how it differs from 100 years ago and what it is like today. I think it really illustrated the point of how quickly things are changing and how important it is for all organizations to build some level of business agility so they can respond to that change. He says, we now live in an age in which the only thing that remains the same is the relentless pace of change.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So the six enablers, the six are leadership and management, organizational culture, organizational structure, people and engagement, governance and funding, and ways of working.
Yeah, and the interesting thing he talks about with these six is that most people just focus on the last one. The ways of working.
Yes.
And that the other five get gotten sort of until you realize that the implementation of changes to your ways of working hasn't had the impact that you wanted. And you need to go back and look at all those other things, which just seems so true. I've just seen that over and over. And while this book is about business agility as a whole, so whole of organization view rather than team level implementation or anything like that. Even when you are working at a lower level, not organization wide, it's still true where you've seen the changes to ways of working and it doesn't have the impact until you actually think about all of those other things, regardless of the level you're doing it at.
Yeah, absolutely. And of the enablers, they're not in any kind of order. Let's chat about leadership and management first, as the first enabler, though.
Yeah, the first and arguably the most important. He does talk about the fact that change needs to be actively driven by leadership. And a couple of the shifts he talks about to move from leadership being directive to more supportive, and also shifting from really centralized decision making to focusing on the work and focusing on providing direction and creating an environment for success. And the thing I find interesting about this is that he's classified leadership and management together.
Yes.
Which is something we've seen separated in some other books. So I think that's an important thing to notice. And he's also talked about pushing the authority to where the information is, to the teams that have the knowledge and the know-how and are involved in it all the time, to make it to make execution really effective and efficient.
I liked the way that he introduced leadership management enabler. He said the leaders themselves need to go through deep learning and growth in their roles. They need to transform the way in which they lead and learn new cognitive and emotional capacities to foster a whole different set of behaviours across their organisation, which I thought was a really short statement, but a really strong statement, because so many times we see leaders say they are supporting, and some of them change and behave to support the teams as well, and there's investment in training people up and all of that sort of stuff, but often the leaders get left behind. They don't get the training and support and things that they need in order to shift the way that they lead, because it's just as we're asking our teams to behave in a different way. Our leaders need to behave in a different way as well. And just because they're leaders doesn't mean that they can figure it out on their own. They do need that support and that coaching as well. So I really liked that he called that out right out front. And I really liked his different, he calls it the leadership agility framework. He talks about expert leadership, where they're tactical problem solvers focusing on making small incremental improvements to existing strategies within their unit. And they tend to be strong command and control micromanagers with low tolerance for conflict and feedback. Then there's the achiever leadership. They're strategic and outcome focused. They believe that their power comes not only from expertise but also from motivating others to contribute to larger objectives over a longer time frame. And then there's the catalysts, the visionaries with a facilitative and culture focus. They nurture that culture, empower those around them, and facilitate their development. They encourage openness, transparency, and participation. He uses the example of the captain on the USS Santa Fe as an example of that catalyst leader. And I think everyone has either read that book, Turn the Ship Around, or has watched that video on YouTube. So I think everyone kind of knows what that means. And if you haven't, check it out. Check out that video. It's a great example.
It's a good one. He's sort of summarized in there as well. I can't remember where in the chapter it was, but I made a note on it where he sort of gives three key points to what a leader's role is. And he said, decide what really matters, number one. Number two, communicate that clearly and succinctly. And number three, give people space and support to execute. Mm. And I just thought that was a great little summary for remembering what's your role here as a leader.
Yeah, definitely. The next enabler is organizational culture.
This is so interesting because he starts this chapter off about talking about how a lot of cultures won't be ready or won't be the right match for aligning to agile values. And to really understand where you're at in your organization, where the culture is at, to make sure that you can make that shift. Because if you're an organization that really values stability and knowing what's next, then this isn't going to be the right fit. So you've got to have a focus on shifting that culture along with shifting the way you do things. And he also talks here, which is one I know we've talked about a bit in the past and probably with books, is around often a mistake people make in introducing agility is to take a prepackaged solution off the shelf and implement that into the business without any consideration for the context that business is working in or the culture that's already there. And I think that's a big thing to be able to, even if you do select a prepackaged solution, to recognize that there will be parts that don't fit with your organizational culture that you might need to shift and adapt some pieces to fit into your kit.
He has some good, he talks about the competing values framework in this chapter as well. It was interesting to read how, in the context of that framework, how different organizations might approach or respond in different ways. And he also talks about subcultures, which I think often gets ignored or doesn't get any kind of attention at all. Because to say that an organization has a culture is a pretty big broad, generic statement. And I was just thinking about that. Maybe that is why, you know, the more IT areas are the ones that get transformed early on, because maybe the subculture within IT is more accepting to the pace of change and things like that than other areas. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we always seem to start with IT and ignore the rest of the organization, or, you know, they come after eventually.
One other thing I liked in this chapter, he talks about identifying the behaviors that you want out of the change, and using that as the catalyst to decide what systems need to change to get those behaviors, what structures need to change, what incentives should be in place to elicit those behaviors that you're looking for.
Yeah.
It's a good way to look at it, not just making a change to a practice or a way you do things and expecting behaviors to change. Backwards view, it's good.
The next enabler is organizational structure.
That shift from the functional silos structure to a more collaborative and cross-functional team structure to really reduce those handoffs between teams. There's a picture in here around the pillars of self-managing teams, which I really liked.
Yeah, and he talks about creating like cross-functional teams that are outcome-focused, not output-focused, and customer-focused outcomes as well.
And that end-to-end capability to deliver on those.
Outcomes.
And then utilising communities of practice to connect those people with the same sort of areas of specialty, performing the same roles. So all the BAs perhaps, so that you've got that knowledge sharing. They can work on defining the standards, building connections. The interesting thing about this structure that he talks about as well is it's a lot less layers and less need for managers. He talks about that in early as well, when he's talking about the functional silos that often organizations start with before changing the structure. He talks about how much waste is in that structure design, particularly around handoffs and waiting time when you're waiting on a different team to complete something, and task switching as well, because you do have that waiting time, or you've got lead times. You tend to switch around and have different priorities or requests from different teams for you to do things or whatever. So there was a lot of talk about the waste involved in that style of structure.
The next enabler was people and engagement.
Yeah, and the need for active management of engagement, and the consideration to perhaps reinvent some of the more traditional HR policies to enable that business agility. I think you talked about the fact that a lot of those traditional HR policies are around diligence and obedience, and really moving to managing for that engagement. But he does talk about the need here to get the hygiene stuff right, you know, make sure you pay people, provide a workspace, focus on people's mental and physical well-being as sort of the underlying basis. Get all that stuff right, and then you can shift to that more managing for engagement approach.
He reflects that he's got a good illustration called the hierarchy of human capability, and what most organizations tend to manage for, which is what you mentioned, the obedience and diligence, which is like 0% and 5%, and then there's intellect, then initiative, creativity, and passion, which is the three things that really matter. He said in his experience, every single one of us has all of the capabilities within us all of the time. They are as natural as breathing and playing. The trick for managers and organisations is to simply not knock them out of people and not turn people into machines programmed for obedience. I liked that. I liked the illustration, especially from a, you know, building a capability perspective and saying that we're capable of all of those things, but these are the things that we need to nurture. And it's interesting because you think about, well, I think about the organizations that I've been in, and when you need that creativity or that, like, there's a different frame of mind that's needed to switch that creativity on. You can't be creative in a one-hour workshop. We need to understand this initiative and we need to estimate it before we walk out of the room in 1 hour or 2 hours or whatever it is. And it's, you can't nurture or you can't get that creativity if you're all sitting online looking at a screen, either PowerPoint slides or Jira, scrolling through Jira. You need to have activities to spark that creativity in people. And there's lots of tools and techniques to do that, but it's one of the things that surprises me, I guess, and I think that it isn't done more. And I think, I don't know if that's because I love facilitating creative sessions. You know, it speaks to our retrospectives and doing the same old, same old, same old retrospective every single time. You're not tapping into those three layers at the top of that. You're not tapping into passion or creativity or initiative. You're tapping into obedience by being there, diligence by doing it every 2 weeks or whatever, and that intellect for just fill out these cards and then we can get out of this room and I can get back to doing something that I want to do.
Follow the process.
Yeah, follow the bouncing ball. I loved that chapter because it's a, from a business agility perspective, it's that capability in people that we need to nurture, and it often just gets treated as a tick box activity. Send them on training and then we'll be sweet. You know, the process says we have to have these communities of practice or chapters or whatever the terminology is, and again, it just turns into a follow the bouncing ball. Why am I here? I don't know why I'm here. I'm just told that I have to be at this community of practice, and it's the same old people talking, running a PowerPoint slide or a Jira screen or something, that just scrolling through, and everyone are kind of like zombies watching, and there's no level of creativity. Maybe we should measure, come up with some kind of way to measure the amount of creative energy happening in those workshops. If you've got time to do other work whilst being in the workshop, then it's not very engaging. It's a good gauge.
A low measure. Yep. Yeah, the thing that surprised me about this chapter, I was sort of expecting it to be quite heavy on the psychological safety stuff, given that's such a trend.
Mm.
But he does address that. He kind of says, "No, acknowledge that I'm not putting a whole heap of stuff in here about psychological safety."
Yes. Yes.
And he says, but if you're being transparent and building trust, if you're over communicating to people and you're treating people like adults, maximizing the autonomy, and you're supporting people to learn and grow, and you're giving recognition both from the manager and from peers, then the psychological safety will come.
Yeah.
He kind of says that's going to, you don't need to focus on psychological safety as a thing by itself, but rather all of those other actions and activities will bring the psychological safety that you're looking for.
The next enabler is governance and funding.
That shift from waterfall, I guess, to that upfront scoping, costing, planning out timelines, to really being able to enable change throughout. He talks about it being from predicting and planning to experimenting and adapting. And in the funding side of it, being about placing a lot of really small bets and incrementally increasing the funding that when viability can be demonstrated.
Mm.
And he proposes a 3-month maximum investment timeline, which I think is just love to see that trialed.
Yeah.
Or I'd love to give it a go in a small team or a large one to get people to show something out of that 3 months rather than just posting along, knowing yep. that there's 2 years worth of funding there and then frantically rushing in the last quarter to deliver stuff.
Yeah. And I had a thought while reading that small bets part as well, thinking, oh, maybe that's why, or maybe that's a reason behind why so many organizations are working in that quarterly kind of time frame from a planning perspective now. But what I've seen is that the quarters are, well, like what you just said, they're just chunk a 3-month chunk of a longer term thing. They're not using those 3 months to learn or experiment. They're just using those 3 months to get break a little bit closer down to that 2-year goal or 3-year goal or whatever it is. It is still to this day, that whole experimentation culture is absent from a lot of organizations. And I think it's driven from that fear of not knowing how to do it, or and also we don't have time. We've got all these other things that we have to do. But from a waste perspective, of all those things that you have to do, how do you know that you have to do them? What data do you have to tell you that these are really important things, that there's large usage? It's something that our customers can't live without. How much of that time are we spending keeping products and services alive that no one, that has a really small impact or not many people use or whatever the outcome is? And from a business agility perspective, how does that, what does that mean for the future? Because Karim up front, he illustrates that companies don't live very long anymore because they're not healthy, or they're not in a state that they can respond fast enough to what their competitors are doing. And the competitors might not even exist today. There's so many startups that just get born out of, you know, just overnight. There's so many things that happen so quickly these days. And there's so many organizations that are trying to be able to respond quicker. They've got that facade that they've got this framework in place that's going to help them be more agile and respond to change. But when the rubber hits the road, or if that situation arises that they need to respond really quickly, can they actually respond really quickly? My guess is no, because of all the processes that are included. Sorry, we have to wait till next quarter.
Yes.
And then we need to get funding for that thing because we've got all this other stuff that we've promised we'll do in next quarter or by the end of the 2-year period or whatever it is. So, not really what we mean when we say being able to respond to change.
And I think so many organizations going through transformation like this get to a point where they know that the governance and funding at an organizational level is holding back their ability to be truly agile. And it tends to be that last hard thing that you've got to tackle.
Yeah.
And it just seems so hard that to shift from that annual budgeting cycle to something that does have a little bit more flex and enables you to stop things, even if you've committed to completing something to the board or whatever. But if you realize that what you're building and what you're doing is not going to reach the outcome that you want, why waste more time and money? Surely that would be a better story for the board to say, yeah, so we spent 3 months, but we're going down the wrong track. Let's not waste more time and more money just doing it just because we've said we're going to, but let's try something different.
Maybe there's a seventh enabler. It's all well and good to say, you know, our leaders need to be, need to change their mindset. But I don't think of the decision makers, such as the board, as leadership. Maybe that's just my naivety, but I kind of see them as another layer on top.
Yeah.
How is their behavior also shifting? What are they doing to be able to support and enable a business or an organization that has agility?
And perhaps within that, for public companies, is shareholders as well, because so often there is a commitment made to the market that something is going to happen, and the market is told we're committing so many millions of dollars to achieve this.
Yep.
And then the market's asking, how are you going? Have you delivered it?
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
So how do you shift that expectation as well, or take them along on the journey?
Yeah, exactly. The last enabler is ways of working.
Yeah, this old chestnut. All the processes, practices, frameworks. This is where he goes through some of the basics, I guess, of agility. Key things he calls out being, you've got to visualize your work, you've got to have daily alignment meetings, you've got to use small batches. But the key with this one is that you can't get results just with these practices.
Yeah.
And with these processes, you have to have all of the other five as well. There's a couple of key things I really liked in this chapter, and one was the mention of slack time, that time and space to pursue ideas and try things out without having to ask for permission to do that.
Yeah.
And the other thing I really liked was he talked about sort of having the guidelines at an organizational level, but allowing teams to really own their own way of working. But if they can own it, then they're more likely to follow it, and they're more likely to be invested in improving how they work as well. So I thought those two things were really key in this chapter that were probably a little bit different to generic ways of working stuff that we've seen before.
I really liked what he included in this chapter as ways of working, and they were just, you know, measuring the flow and where finding where the waste is, and Kaizen, and visualizing and communicating and collaborating and self-organizing. Like he could have used other more specific things, but he went back to the crux of what kind of behaviors we want to build in our teams in order to support agility within the organization. And so I really liked the things that he chose. I like the way how he related ways of working. He said, think of these ways of working as apps installed atop the underlying operating system. There are many from which to choose, and every organization will have its own unique combination for its unique context. And every team within an organization will have their own as well. So I really liked the way that it's kind of simplified things a little bit, because everyone is very familiar with apps on a phone or some device. So I'm going to try and remember that analogy for when I am, you know, training people to try and help them see how it gets applied on top of the organization. It's doing these things isn't going to make you or agile isn't going to make your organization agile. It's just one step along the way. There's lots of other stuff as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like you said, it doesn't sort of force one framework or say that everybody must do Scrum or these specific practices. He just gets more into the underlying values of it. Loved it.
He does have a business agility canvas in the book as well, and you can download it for free from his website. And I think it summarizes the book really well. So, yes, it would be really interesting to run that as an exercise for organizations that are already going through a transformation to kind of categorize or to think, put that lens over the things that they're doing to go, yes, we are doing that, or no, actually, we've completely ignored that. And maybe that's where we're going wrong.
Yeah. Well, he summarizes at the end as well, that there's a section about why you'll fail it, through a transformation like this. And he mentions some things like middle management resistance, and if you are narrowly focused, like just adjusting your ways of working and nothing else. Mm-hmm. So some of the sort of pitfalls or traps that you might fall into. So I like that was sort of a keep an eye out for these things that might go wrong. So you're aware and you can identify them if you see them happening and pivot accordingly.
Mm.
It's a nice little way to wrap up the book, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. So who would you recommend read this book?
Everyone. I bought a stack of these books after we read it and gave them out to a lot of people that I was working with at the time. I don't know if it did any good, but it's a book that I always have a spare one to give out to people if I think they'll get value from it. And it's a book I regularly refer back to. There's not a lot of those, but this is one of those ones I find myself picking up regularly to, what did Karim say about this? I know there's something in his book about this. There's something I can use to share with someone. There's a lot of good stuff in here. It's rare to find a book that is really about business agility as a whole and more of that systems thinking side of things than just being that ways of working section.
Definitely. Yes. Like we said at the start, it's easy to read. There's a lot of stuff in there. It'd be an awesome book to book club with someone else or a group of people. Imagine a leadership team reading this book and having a regular book club where they discuss what they're doing, what they're not doing, what they learnt from the chapter and what they could apply to their organisation or to themselves. Yeah, I think it would be really powerful and might just support in that whole mindset shift that is needed at that leadership level anyway.
Yeah, totally. I totally recommend leadership teams going through transformation to do exactly that.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's the other great thing about it is that it is not specific to any one context, to any one business type, or you can apply it anywhere and everywhere. All organizations can easily use this information. It doesn't get specific into technology or specific parts of the business. It really is whole of business approach.
Thanks, Anita. Till next book.
Thanks, Renee.
Thank you for listening to The Leaders Playlist. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please be sure to share our podcast with your family, friends, and work colleagues. Until next episode.